You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So I'm recording this episode on November 10th, 2024, and by now, obviously, everybody has heard about the outcome of the elections. And before I talk about Elon Musk, I'd be remiss not to mention it because it occupied so much of our time and attention for the past few months. And, you know, the first thing to say is, although it's like clearly disappointing, I have to say it's not that surprising. Like the first time that Trump won in 2016, I can honestly say that I was devastated. I was shocked. I was confused. I describe it as like the moment where my cherry was popped, because I think it's almost like the day that I first became an adult, because back then, like my political experience was relatively limited. Like the first election I remember following was the 2008 Obama versus Trump and Hillary campaign. And I was so invested. I was invested, and I don't even know why I was that invested, because one, I lived in Ireland. Two, I'm not an American citizen. Three, I didn't really know much about politics. I didn't know anything about politics. All I knew was that my family was super excited. I remember like my uncles, like my uncle Justin and his family came over and they stayed at our house. My uncle Mark was over. It was like a house was packed with like 15 people who like had left their homes and were camped out at my house watching like the elections well past midnight. Because obviously here in Ireland and in the UK, we don't get the news until like very late in the evening. Like most people probably go to bed not having found out who has won. And then they wake up the next day and they find out who the winner is. So I just remember the 2008 election being such an exciting time. And even up to the run-up, I was so invested. I talked about it all the time at school, to the point where when we found out the next day that Obama had won, I went into school and like all the teachers were like patting me on the back. They were like high-fiving me. They were like, oh, he won, he won. They were like congratulating me as though me at like, I think I was like 16, 15 at that time. They were patting on me on the back and like congratulating me as though I personally had ran his campaign. So that was like my first impression of American politics. It was my first impression of being invested in the outcome of the US elections, like my family and our cousins and my uncles and all of us huddled up until like 1, 2, 3 a.m. just trying to find out who won before we went to bed. And I had to go to bed because I had school. And so that was my first impression. So then Obama goes through his 8 years in office, and then it comes down to 2016 and it's Hillary Clinton versus Trump. And at that time, I never liked Hillary, because even in my younger days, I always had the thing that I remembered about her, that she had called the Central Park Five super predators. I don't know how I knew that or why I knew that at that age, so I was super young, but I just had that in my mind. And I never could, like, whenever she would give all these speeches about breaking glass ceilings and about how she was the future and about all the things that she was going to do for African Americans, like, I always had that thought in my head. But I still rooted for her because I obviously didn't want Trump to win, because even back then, we already had the tape released of him talking about how he grabs women by their genitals. We hadn't yet heard about the Jeffrey Epstein debacle and his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. We hadn't really like received hard evidence about his bankruptcies and the fact that he has like singularly mismanaged the money he inherited from his father. We didn't have like insight into all his messiness. We didn't know about Stormy Daniels. We didn't know about all that, but we knew enough to know, or I knew enough to know, that he was like a bad dude, a sexist dude, a misogynistic dude. And also that I don't know if I knew this like explicitly, but I also connected him to being a racist. I think what I had learned about him at that age that like stuck in my mind was the fact that he wouldn't lease his apartments to African Americans. So basically, after the 2008 elections of Obama and Hillary, and then the 2016, I wasn't as excited about the outcome, although I still was like heavily invested. I just knew that both candidates were like baddies. They were bad, but like one was worse. So clearly I was rooting for Hillary. So, skipping ahead then to the moment he was announced as being the winner, I was so shocked. I have to say, I feel like something in me shattered, because at that time, I'd only had positive experiences of American politics. So I wasn't around, for example, when Bush won over Al Gore. I wasn't around for that. I wasn't around during the Nixon years or the Reagan years. Basically, I wasn't around for other Republican wins that were like, you know, like earth-shattering wins. That was my first experience. And especially because with Trump, it wasn't just because of his scandals. It was the fact that he wasn't a career politician. In my mind, it was only people who'd like been previous senators or congressmen or women or who otherwise had careers in politics that were electable because they had a demonstrated history of doing the job or a similar job as the presidency would require. So here comes like this orange man whose background is in television or entertainment, who has all like a handful of scandals to his name, and he's kind of just like a joke character. He's the character that's parodied in South Park and like Simpsons. He's not a serious person. So I just didn't think, one, I didn't think he would go as far as he did even in the first place. I didn't think he would become the Republican nominee. I didn't think that he would be able to raise that much capital. And then I certainly wasn't expecting him to win. So coming up to this 2024 election, all that has happened. So like, honestly, I can say the wall has cleared for my eyes. I have a much more balanced like view of what the outcome is going to be. I'm not as idealistic as I once was, but still it was disappointing. I have to say though as well, and you know, maybe a part of this is coming from like internalized misogyny, in that I'm scrutinizing Kamala Harris more than I would a male candidate. You know, I don't know if I scrutinized Joe Biden as much when he was running, but I have to say, you know, I secretly wasn't rooting for Kamala Harris either. Like, and part of it is like the identity politics that have been shoved down our throats so much during this campaign. It was like a forceful presentation of Kamala Harris as a black person that I don't like. And I honestly think that like Kamala Harris being presented as a black person can only happen in a place like the US, because in any other scenario, like in the UK, she's just a biracial person. She's clearly a biracial person. Nobody would call her a black person. In African countries, like people would not call her, in most African countries, they would not call her a black person. Only in the US where can somebody who's like an eighth, I think she's like an eighth black, be presented as a black candidate. So already I didn't like that. Also because unlike Obama, who actually has a black family, like she didn't really have black people surrounding her. So it was more difficult to accept her as a black candidate. And then also they pushed the angle too much in my view. I remember seeing like a picture, like a poster of, and this was like an official campaign poster, and it had Martin Luther King on the far left. In the middle, it had Barack Obama. And on the far right, it had Kamala Harris. It was basically trying to say that first we have Martin Luther King, who set the path for Obama, who then became a historic figure in that he was the first black president the United States has ever seen. And now the future is Kamala Harris. And I was like, this just feels a little bit too heavy-handed, you know, especially because Kamala Harris isn't that figure of like, for me personally, when I watch her speak, when I watch her public engagements, I'm not moved in that history-making way. So I felt like those posters and that like forceful representation of her as a black woman was just overdone in this election. Also, I have to say, like, in the past, I used to believe that the presidential debates were real. It's kind of like when I found out that WWE wasn't real. I used to believe that WWE was real. So I was so invested. Like, I loved it. I watched it all the time on TV. You know, I would, I'm ashamed to say this, but I would like practice the moves. I would be so invested in the storyline. And then the minute I found out it wasn't real, like I just never watched it again. Same with the presidential debates. I mean, I've kind of gone back to it now, but there was a time when I thought like they got the questions in real life, or rather in real terms. As in like, I didn't know that the questions were pre-planned, or that they had seen the questions ahead of time, that they had prepped for the questions, that they basically had a script they had to follow. I didn't know all that. I felt or thought at the time that it was a real debate. Now that I'm older and wiser, I obviously know that it's highly scripted, that they get the questions ahead of time, that the issues are made digestible for the public. It's also clear that they kind of think the public is stupid because literally no policy detail is ever discussed in these debates. And obviously, they tell a lot of lies, especially more, I have to say, on the Republican side, but also there are some misrepresentations on the Democrat side. Like, lies just go unchecked. So clearly they don't think we're able to discern the truth. But that's okay, because although I no longer believe that it's a real debate where people are exchanging ideas and thoughts and policies in real time, I still enjoy entertainment. Now I see it as like a performance, as a piece of theater. And as a piece of theater, I have to say, like, I still wasn't impressed. Like, it's supposed to be an exchange of people sparring against one another, and they're supposed to convince us that they're passionate, they're engaged, they're well-informed, they've got like an idea of how they want to shape their office or the government that they will be the head of. And even as a piece of theater, I just didn't think she came across particularly well. She came across well. I have to say, she came across eloquent, she came across like competent, solid. She came across, but it wasn't powerful. It felt very meek. And then on top of that, I learned that she literally had said she was not going to be accepting any questions from the audience. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, so we're basically all tuning in to watch you guys rehearse things, like rehearse a show that you have practiced. So it just dampens the whole excitement of the debates even more when you know that there is nothing about it is unscripted. And even within that context of knowing that it is completely scripted from beginning to end, I still thought to myself, like, I'm not moved, I'm not impressed, I'm not excited by her. I'd also seen a whole bunch of stuff where in public appearances, predominantly appearances that she had in black spaces, like, I felt like she was doing blackface. I felt like I was watching somebody who's being described as a black person, like, doing blackface to black audiences. And a lot of it came down to, like, one, her accents that shift so much. It's almost like she takes on the accents of like the black audience that she's performing to. So in some instances, she would have like this southern drawl. In other instances, she would start using terms like my brothers and sisters, you know, stuff that clearly she's uncomfortable saying, and language she clearly does not use it. And you can always tell as well, by the way, when people call you brother or sister, when they're not used to using that language, like, you can tell it's not part of their regular lingo. So the southern drawl, the using language she clearly does not use often. I think I saw a video as well where she like sounded like semi like Caribbean. It felt like somebody who is desperate to connect with a black audience that she clearly does not identify as or does not come from. Otherwise, there wouldn't be that like incongruency. Like, it would naturally flow if she was of the people. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to try to belong to something you belong unless you don't belong in some way. And sometimes, like, people don't belong because they have removed themselves from that group. Like, they don't see themselves of that group. And so they do and say things that alienate the group or that creates a distance between themselves and the group, even though naturally they are part of that group. Sometimes that happens. But I also felt on her level, I just honestly didn't feel like she spent a lot of time around black people. That's what it felt like. Even watching an interview she did, interviews is generous. It was basically like a fun sort of fluff piece, like fluff interview she did with Keke Palmer, who I really like. And Keke Palmer asked her a whole bunch of questions. One of them was like a silly fun question, and it was asking her about how she does her hair, like how does she do her silk press. And then Kamala Harris says she doesn't do a silk press. The way that she gets her hair straightened, or the way that she straightens her hair, is that she uses a round brush, like a round bristle brush, and a hair dryer. And again, like, anybody who has like African hair, who has like Afro textured hair, who has like hair that is in any way black, like, knows that that just would never work. Like, you are not going to take a round brush and a hair dryer and get the curls out of your hair and get your hair to look the way her hair looks, where it's completely straight, like completely like curl free. You know, like, only white women can achieve that straightness. And I'm not saying she's a white woman, but only white women, and I shouldn't have said white women, only people with like that hair type. Like, think of Indian women's hair or Chinese people's hair or European women's hair. They have different like thickness and different like qualities to that hair, but it's like largely straight, and all they need to like get out any wave or curve is like a round brush. But for anybody with Africanness in them, honestly, like, a round brush is never going to cut it, especially in the context of the question that Kiki asked, which was like a silk press, which is when you use like really hot tongs to straighten your hair, and you use the really hot tongs because otherwise the curls are still going to be there. So I just thought it was like a little moment of that was revealing. And what it was revealing to me was that she was clearly playing a role. Like, she was clearly like saying the things that she thinks she has to say to win over the black audience. Like, her being interviewed by Kiki Palmer, who's like beloved by the black community, is not coincidence. Like, clearly that's tactical. And also, if she had represented herself as just like the first woman of color, that I feel like she could be authentic in herself and in her personality, and she wouldn't have to do like this obvious pandering that didn't come across well. And then also, I think though that people sitting opposite her would be asking her different questions. If she identified as, for example, as a South Asian woman, as much as she identifies as a black woman, nobody would be asking her about her silk press. And then she wouldn't have to like say things that make people think like, that's weird. But to be honest, like, all these are tangential reasons, or they're extra reasons or side reasons why I kind of took a dislike to her. For me, it actually all originated around her comments around Israel-Palestine. I remember it was like October 2023, and this was at the height of student protests, where students were like boycotting universities. They were organizing protests. They were organizing sit-ins. They were occupying campuses. So like setting up camps and tents and just living on campuses, thereby preventing the universities from being able to continue in like a business as usual way. So I thought it was just like an exciting time, like a really interesting time to observe. And you would think, as like the Democrat nominee, that even if she politically has to take a stance in favor of Israel, because like no matter who the president was going to be, they were unlikely to shift their position on Israel meaningfully, because Israel is such an important proxy for them in so many different ways. So I wasn't expecting her to say, we're going to demand a two-state solution or a one-state solution from tomorrow. We're going to withdraw financial support from Israel. We're going to withdraw weapon support from Israel. We're going to launch missiles at Israel if they continue to attack the Palestinians. I wasn't expecting any of that. I'm not naive, or at least I'm not that naive. However, I did expect her to say things that didn't alienate or pathologize the protests that these students were organizing, because they were so amazing to see. They were so powerful to see. It was so nice seeing like young people so active, passionate, motivated. And they did it for like prolonged periods of time. It wasn't just sort of like this digital like activism where you see somebody put up a square for like a couple of days then it's forgotten about. It was like incredibly sustained and required a great degree of self-sacrifice, risking being arrested, being put on social media, being expelled from the universities, like tremendous amount of sacrifice. So I would have expected her, I just expected her to be more sympathetic. I expected her to say something to the effect of, we are moved, or support the students' right to freedom of speech, or we support students, like the students' activism and their passion for the Palestinian issue, and it's a complicated issue, and we're doing our best to find a solution that is workable for all. Like something to the effect, something that basically like said anything other, honestly, than what she said. Anything other than saying, we defend Israel's right unequivocally to self-defense, because again, it's literally what the right says. It was using language that the Republicans use, that the right side uses. So it was a very strange tactic to take. And then on top of that, she makes that statement, and in my head, I was like, okay, bet, obviously that's what you believe, and that's the stance you're going to take. But clearly she went back to the polls. She realized that she was doing that, that statement or those comments were costing her politically, and she literally comes back and tries to do a 180 and basically tries to walk back what she had said. So for me, automatically, I already, like, there was already a bad taste in my mouth. And from that point forward, like, it was very difficult to sort of, like, see her in the way that she was trying to present herself. Because on the one hand, she's, like, putting herself on posters with, like, Martin Luther King, who, by the way, you know, one of the things that people say cost him his life is the fact that he came out and stood up for the Vietnamese. He stood up against the Vietnam War at a time when it was very politically costly to do so. So it was just an odd stance to take. And also, she didn't need to take such an aggressive stance. She could have taken a stance that sort of like assuaged the more like conservative Democrats while still not alienating young people. And also, by the way, at this stage, it was like literally like 30,000 Palestinians had already been killed. So even with that background, it was a strange thing for her to come out and make such forceful pronouncements in favor of Israel. Now, the final thing I'll say about the elections before I move on to Elon Musk is, you know, we can't ignore the fact that Latinos were a major subject in this elections. And like, my first thought was, I have always been suspicious. Like, there are certain groups of people I know, like, there's like a little bit of a question mark around their solidarity, shall we say. And Latinos are, especially like white passing Latinos, like they are in that category. So they come out and they vote in large numbers for Trump. And I think for me, the question that this raises, or the point that this reminds me of, is the POC label, the people of color label, the way that we just brandish this label and sort of put this label on anybody who isn't white, and we end up grouping large swathes of people who honestly have no business being together, because we assume that just because we are all non-white that we have shared interests or our interests are aligned. But honestly, that couldn't be further from the truth. Like, we're not a monolith. Like, we see reminders of this all the time. One of the things, you know, outside the Latina vote in this 2024 election, one of the things I think about is the recent, like, affirmative action suit that was launched by Chinese Americans. Was it Chinese Americans or just Asian Americans? I'm pretty sure they're predominantly Chinese. But that was launched by Chinese Americans that was challenging universities' affirmative action, which is basically designed to reserve certain amounts of spots for people of color, or specifically African Americans. And what their contention was that these spots, these affirmative action spots, were going to African Americans in a way that disadvantaged Chinese Americans. And they were basically saying that Chinese Americans get higher scores, which, by the way, wasn't true. And that despite getting similar or higher scores than African Americans, they are underrepresented, or they are chosen at a lower rate or to a lower extent than African Americans. And as an aside, actually, the reason why affirmative action was even brought in was as a consequence of the civil rights movement of 1968 or the late 1960s, where an attempt to redress the inequality that was embedded in a system in which African Americans weren't able to go to these universities, weren't able to like get the same level of education. It was basically designed to balance the scales, to allow them to catch up to the white population who had excluded them from the education system for so long. So that's the reason why it was even in place in the first place. And what we saw, though, after the winning of the lawsuit is that the numbers of Asian Americans who are admitted to universities, and they're specifically talking about like prestigious elite universities. They're talking about like the Harvards, the Yales, the Princetons, the Dukes. They're talking about those universities. What we have seen is that like they didn't get the results that they thought they were going to get after they won the lawsuit, after the Supreme Court, like, you know, disbanded affirmative action. So what's happened is very mixed, but predominantly has been negative for Asian Americans. So Yale, for example, Princeton, Duke, and many other universities have actually experienced reduced intakes of Asian Americans, like lower numbers than pre-affirmative action, which tells you that the Asian Americans were already benefiting themselves from affirmative action. And then in other universities like Harvard, the numbers have stayed the same. And then in, I forget what it was, but like when they looked at the analysis at places like UCLA, they actually found that Asian Americans were already like overrepresented. And so post affirmative action, they haven't seen like a surge in numbers. They've seen numbers either stay the same or decline. So again, it goes back to my point about, you know, with the Latino vote coming out so strong for Trump, like reminding us again that we shouldn't be so like reckless in how we like group people together. There are groups of people whose interests are mutually exclusive or whose interests aren't aligned. I also think this as well about not just Chinese Americans in the US context. I also just think about that of Chinese people in the African context. Like, I don't know if you've seen those videos where you'll see like Chinese business owners in African countries like, I don't know, Kenya or Uganda or Nigeria. And one particular video I saw like a while back was of this guy, this Chinese man who owned a factory, and he had this, it was like a trolley that you stand on, and typically it's the kind of trolley you use to like move heavy goods in like a factory. So he was standing on this like manual trolley, like two-wheel manual trolley, and then it had like two handles at the front, and he had two African men like pulling him forward, like literally like treating them like slaves. Or like the story that came out of Abuja in Nigeria, where there was this Chinese shopping mall that wasn't admitting any Nigerian people, like in Nigeria, excluding Nigerians from being able to enter the premises of the shopping center. Now, thankfully, that's been shut down. But again, what these two instances show is that we're not like POC as a label, honestly, to me, doesn't make sense because our interests in many respects aren't aligned. And a lot of the time as well, there are power dynamics and power plays involved that mean that you're banding together groups of people whose interests are mutually exclusive, or where one's interest is white aligned and the other is aligned with people of color. I will say, though, as far as the Latino vote goes, although it was, like, you know, disappointing, probably embarrassing for Latinos to see those numbers come out, like, we shouldn't scapegoat them as well. Like, ultimately, the people responsible for Trump's win are the majority population, which is the white population. They make up 71% of the population, and so the majority of the blame, or the majority of the praise, depending on what side you are, has to go there. And although, of course, if you add up like the 8 percentage points that represents the Latino vote and also like some wayward African-American votes, I think it was like 3 percentage points, then of course they would have made a difference to Kamala Harris winning, but they weren't the determining reason. Like, we can't look at the people at the margins and blame them for an outcome when it's the majority of the vote that determines the path to who wins. I will say, though, you know, another example of how Trump voters vote against their own interests is, you know, I honestly don't understand the rationale, because this man has ran an election cycle, actually not just even this election cycle, the last time he was running as well, ran an election cycle in which he was calling Mexican men like rapists and killers. And so it's really disturbing to have like Latino men see that, know that, see how it affects how they're portrayed in the media, how they're portrayed in society, how it affects them. Also the focus on like anti-immigration coming from south of the border. It was really disturbing to see them know all of that about Trump and still vote for him, you know? Which makes me think as well, like, people are motivated by so many different things outside, like, their racial identity. In that case, I can only assume they voted for him based on either self-hatred or around the, like, his stance against women or his stance on women or his stance on abortion. I assume that's the reason. Now, moving on to Elon Musk, there is honestly so many things you can say about this man. I will say, like on the lighter note or funnier side, like, even just looking at him as, like, it feels like he's somebody who has a lot of money, and despite having all that money, he's still a loser. Like, in like the most, like, juvenile, like, high school sort of way, like, he's still a loser. I remember watching him come out, this is like a few years ago, it was like a Dave Chappelle concert, and Dave Chappelle, I don't know what possessed him to do so or how much Elon paid him to do so, but Dave Chappelle, like, halfway through his performance, through his show, brings out Elon Musk, and the audience, like, starts booing him. They're so confused at why he's there. Like, presumably Elon Musk thought he'd get cool points or acceptance points or support just because he was seen with Dave Chappelle. But he gets wheeled out on stage, like, people boo him, and then he kind of, like, awkwardly steps to the side for a while, and then he gives, like, this really, like, limp speech, and then he leaves whilst other people are booing him. Yeah, really, really awkward. Or another thing that makes me giggle is watching him. He came out with, like, one of his Tesla models. It was, like, for, like, some truck. And he was, like, talking about how, like, the truck was bulletproof and that basically, like, nothing could get into this vehicle. So he has, like, his car on stage in front of an audience. And to demonstrate how, like, robust the windows are, he has, like, a stunt where he's going to throw a rock, or he's going to have his employee throw a rock at the window, and it's going to show that despite the big rock, the windows aren't going to shatter. So the demonstrator, the guy, throws the rock at the window, and it breaks, like, it goes through the window. Like, it's so stupid. And then he does it a second time, like, basically trying to say, like, that was a weird coincidence. It's not going to happen again. Throws the second rock, and again, it goes through the window. Or, like, that meme. I don't know if you've seen that meme of him standing behind Trump, and Trump has just won. I don't know if it's, actually, I think it's at a rally. And Trump has said something that Elon obviously finds exciting. And he, like, jumps in the air with his hands up. But the way he jumps and the way he has his hands up and the way the meme is, it's like it shows him, his feet not touching the air. I mean, his feet not touching the ground, his arms extended outward to the sky. But his face is, like, completely joyless. There's no excitement or happiness or joy. It's like this joyless person just jumping for joy but with no joy. Like, it's a really funny, like, still that somebody captured of him. So for me, like, on a petty level, he just strikes me as somebody who is desperate to be liked, to have other people's, like, popularity be smeared on him by association. Like, if he stands close enough to Dave Chappelle, or if he stands close enough to, like, Trump, eventually people will like him, and despite all of that, people still don't like him. So that's the first, like, petty thing I will say about him. But outside of that, for me, like, the first thing to know about Elon Musk, or the things that I have observed as I have watched him from the sideline hating, is that he's just a pathological liar across literally every silo, like, every metric you can think of. When you think about his career, the first thing is, like, you notice is how he misrepresents, like, the businesses that have been, like, heavily associated with him, or the businesses that kind of have been career making for him. The first one is his misrepresentation with PayPal. So he, especially in earlier interviews, like, always talked about how he founded PayPal. But the thing is, he didn't found PayPal. PayPal was founded by three other people. It was this guy called Max Levchin, Peter Thiel, that other billionaire, like, villain who I'm going to do an episode on. And then this other guy called Luke Nozick, and they founded the company in 1998. Elon Musk became involved because initially he was an investor. I think he initially invested something like $5 million into PayPal. And then after a while, after a couple of years, his business, X, merged with PayPal's business, whose parent company was called Cofinity. They founded together and then they became this new entity. But PayPal as a structure, as a company, as a business, as like the technology already existed and significantly predated Elon Musk's involvement. But you would never know that by hearing him talk about it. The other thing that he misrepresents as far as his career goes is that he founded Tesla. And again, this is a complete fabrication because it was founded by two guys, one called Martin Eberhard and the other guy called Mark Tarpening, and they founded the company in 2003, and Musk didn't get involved until 2008 when he invested in the company. So like PayPal, he wasn't a founder, he wasn't the person who developed the technology, he wasn't the person who got the company, the business off the ground or made it what it is. He's an investor who came in at a late stage. And I find like these lies that he tells about PayPal and Tesla like really curious, because there's nothing wrong with being an investor. Like, it's a great thing being an investor because you invest in startup businesses and you make it possible for them to continue to research and develop their technologies and to bring new products to the market. That's like I'm not gonna say noble because it's not noble, but it's like a great thing that people do. I think the reason why he misrepresents this and misrepresents his generous, the reason why he lies about this is that he wants the kudos associated with being a founder, because those kudos are connected to being perceived as like an intelligent person. So being an investor in like PayPal and Tesla is not as impressive as being the people who literally created the technology for PayPal. It's not as impressive as being the people who designed one of the most recognizable brands of EV or of electric vehicles. So he wants the kudos of, or the Silicon Valley trope of like the super smart genius guy who like creates these technology. He wants that, and he can't have that if he's just an investor. So he can only have that if he is involved in the foundation or in the founding of these companies. And I think that's why he creates these myths. The other myth around him, like that pertains to his career, is the idea that he is self-made. And I have to say, like literally all millionaires who were handed money from their parents or who inherited wealth, like, love this story. And they love this story from the simple reason that they know the public will always root for an underdog, and they will always wish well for somebody who has a rags to riches story, in a way where they don't have that empathy for somebody who was born with a silver spoon in their mouth and went on to be like wealthy, like continue to be wealthy. So because people know that people inherently don't like people who are born with wealth, they basically try to reverse engineer their history into that narrative. And you get like preposterous comments like we had from Trump in the first election cycle in 2016, where he says like he's a self-made man because all his dad gave him was a $1 million loan to start his business, as though like any regular person will ever see that kind of money from their parents. So same with Elon Musk. He presents this image of having founded his company. He had like a couple of companies before he ended up investing and then acquiring or partly acquiring PayPal. I forget the name of it, but he said that his father gave him like a modest check of like $25,000 in the late 1980s. And from that, he was able to start his business. And he really likes to ham up the story of him like sleeping in his office, showering across the street at a YMCA because he couldn't afford to have an apartment, presumably, and he had to like live where he worked. But in this like, in the sanitized, mythologized narrative of how he came to be a billionaire, you should remember this one thing. And this one thing is that I guarantee you, there is not a person alive who is a billionaire who wasn't born with wealth. Like, it is, I would bank more on Jesus coming back next Tuesday than banking on the fact that any walking billionaire was born without inherited wealth in some way, because that's just the nature of wealth in a lot of respects. Like, even when you look at Elon's story, like, if you zoom out of, like, the just, like, the falsities and, like, the myths he's trying to sell us, what we know about Elon Musk's, even before investigating, we know this. We know that he was born into apartheid South Africa. And I just looked up the date of his birth. He was born in 1971. So in 1971, we know that apartheid in South Africa ends in 1994, I believe. It was 1994. So between 1971 and 1994, South Africa is still basically a colonized country in which the Africans, the Black Africans, have no legal standing. They could be arrested, they could be killed, they could be raped, they could be, their property could be taken away from them, they couldn't vote, like, they had no rights. So up until Elon leaves South Africa in, like, the 80s, the late 80s, he lived in this society. And he lived in this society as a white man who had basically all the advantages and all the privileges and was the expropriator, shall we say, of the wealth of Africans, in that African people, Black African people, toiled for very little money in factories, in mines, in shops and restaurants, in all these places for, like, next to nothing. And they also worked in terrible conditions. But the recipients of this transfer of wealth, and by transfer of wealth I mean the money that isn't paid to the African population, and ends up being profits by the white occupying or colonizing population. Elon Musk came from this category of people. He came from the people who, during apartheid South Africa, lived in South Africa as white beneficiaries of the inequality that that defined apartheid. It literally was the whole point. And so, like, from this perspective, like, him trying to sell us the notion that he's a self-made man is never going to fly when you live in a state that is structurally designed at every single level to transfer money, wealth, resources from the Black majority African population to the white minority population. That's not going to fly. Like, automatically we know that he has a massive leg up from any Black South African, for example. But even beyond that, we can tell that he's talking, like, nonsense, because I don't know personally, I don't know any, like, 30-year-old person who is able to make, like, $300+ million on a business transaction at that age. And that's exactly what happens to Elon Musk. In the late 1990s, he goes from being, like, a multimillionaire to, like, being a millionaire in the hundreds. He goes from having, like, a net worth of, like, 12 million, I think it is, to having a net worth of, like, 300 million. Again, that implies that he was already a millionaire before 30. And for you to be a millionaire before 30, when you say that your parents were, like, had humble beginnings, like, your dad was in the government for a little while, but then he had, like, these business interests, like, it's clearly a fabricated story. Like, the only way that that story makes sense, that he becomes, like, a 20-something year old man who becomes a millionaire, and then by his 30s, he's made, like, $300 million in a business transaction, and then, like, a decade later, he enters the billionaire status. That only happens when he starts the race of life, or the game of life, with a significant hand up, which is exactly what happened. Now, outside his career lies, the other lies that he tells is around his philanthropy. Like, he's notorious for saying he's going to donate money to a cause, like, a good cause, and then just, like, not following through it, just not doing anything about it, because it seems as though he's only interested in the publicity, and once the articles have been published, he kind of already has what he wants, and he never really had any intention to follow through. A really prominent example of this is when he was asked by the UN if he would be willing to donate $6 billion, and $6 billion at the time was worth about 2% of his net worth. And Musk said, like, in a sort of, like, cheeky, like, snarky way, that if the UN could, like, explain to him exactly how this $6 billion would go towards like obliterating or solving world hunger, then he would do it. So the UN like goes to work, and obviously they've got like tremendous amount of data, so I'm sure it wasn't particularly difficult for them to show how this money would be useful. They come back to him 3 days later, and they show him this like massive report that shows him like where the $6 billion would go, how the $6 billion would help in the fight against world hunger. And they show that those $6 billion could actually contribute to feeding 42 million people worldwide. And after that publication is made, after the UN gives him that report, guess what? Like literally nothing ever happens. He doesn't give him the money. He doesn't like talk about it again. In fact, he kind of goads them, because a little while later, it's revealed that he has given $6 million to like another organization, another charity. But then it turns out the charity that he gave that $6 billion to was himself. So he's got a foundation like Bill Gates. You should check out my Bill Gates episode, by the way, where I talk about how he uses his philanthropic work to evade paying taxes. He does the same thing that Bill Gates and other billionaires do, in that he set up a philanthropic organization that looks on the surface like it does good worldwide, but actually it's a tax haven. They basically are able to offset some of the taxes that they should be paying against the charitable donations that they make, even though the charitable donations are to their own organizations. And BTW, like, it's yet to be seen like what charitable causes his philanthropic quote-unquote organization has made. So anyway, the $6 billion that the UN asked for, that he asked them to, that he asked the UN to like justify, ends up just going back into his own pocket and through a different mechanism. For me though, like the lies that he tells are really interesting as far as his career goes, but then also as far as his personal life goes. And to be honest, when you're looking at it, the lies he tells in his personal life or that he has told, it really shows you like how petty the man is. The first thing that I picked up on was how he lied about how his child died. So he had a son with his first wife called Justine Wilson, and unfortunately the baby passed away from Cott's death. So you know when a baby just dies for like no fault, just suddenly dies for no reason. So their baby unfortunately went through that. It died that way, and he like released a post in which he said he had been holding his son when his son took his final breath, when his son transitioned from life to death. And he writes that to presumably garner sympathy from his followers and from the people that follow him. And then his ex-wife Justine says, like, for what it's worth, like, that's not true. Like, I was the one who was holding the baby when the baby died. And she doesn't like speculate on why he says that or why he said that. She just makes it as a statement, like, just for what it's worth, yeah, I was holding the baby. So even lying about something that is so like on the surface like detail, like ultimately when you lose a child, what does it matter who was holding the child as it died? It's only meaningful insofar as he felt a need to capitalize upon a devastating situation for personal gain, like personal like social media points or social or personal like sympathy points, when he already had that because he lost a child. And also as well to like kind of misrepresent such a sacred moment feels icky. Like it's really confusing why you would do that. So there's that. The other thing, like on a much lighter note, is he was married to Justine Wilson for a minute, and then he ends up getting divorced from her. And she's got this article that she wrote when they got divorced. It's basically like, it didn't read like a character assassination, but she's basically just like, it's a character assassination, but it's done in a very polite way, I would say. But anyway, in this article, she talks about how Elon Musk divorces her, and then within a few weeks he's engaged to somebody else, which tells you they were sleeping together while they were married. He was cheating on her the whole time. So they get engaged very quickly. But the lie that he tells is that when his second wife, her name was Tallulah Riley, she files for divorce from him after 4 years. What he says, though, is that he goes on social media and he basically says that he's the one who's divorced Tallulah, and that he's the one who filed for divorce. And he talks about it to such an extent that a reporter reaches out to him to interview him or to question him about the divorce because it's a news interest story to them, I guess. And in that, he takes the call and produces like this whole interview where he's talking about like the dissolution of his marriage and why he chose to end it. Meanwhile, like a while later, months later, the filing of the divorce becomes publicly available. And surprise, surprise, the person who filed for divorce is not him, as he'd been claiming on social media and in the article with that journalist. It turns out it's Tallulah who had filed for divorce, as is the case in like literally the majority of heterosexual relationships. 9 times out of 10, it's always the woman who files for divorce. So again, to misrepresent like such a trivial, it's not even trivial, because obviously the dissolution of a marriage is very important. It's trivial in that it matters to him how it's perceived by the public, namely that the public believes that he's the one who initiated the divorce. So it speaks to a very like fragile sense of ego that detail in the context of a massive, what would be for many people a traumatic experience going through a divorce. It's kind of a little bit pathetic that to him, like an important thing is that he's not portrayed as somebody who has been left. He'd like to be portrayed as somebody who did the leaving. Now, the final thing I'll say about his personal life, and this isn't a lie that he's told or a misrepresentation that he has made. This just speaks to the general messiness of his personal life. And by the way, more on this later, is the fact that he has 11 children. He had 12 children, one has died, so he's got 11 children. He's got like 6 with his first wife. He's got 3 with the singer Grimes. And then he has 2 with like this business exec. I don't know if she's a business exec. I just know it's somebody who worked for him or works for him. So he's got 2 with her. And it's messy as well because one of the births of the children coincided with the birth of his children with Grimes while he was still with Grimes. So clearly he was cheating on her as well. So with the 12 children, I'm going to talk about later about how like right-wing people have a lot of children and how that's connected to like the replacement theory where they feel that the white population is becoming a minority. So I think that his 11/12 children like is aligned with that, especially with his pivot to the right that we have seen in recent years, in particular, obviously in the 2024 election where he heavily backed Donald Trump. So I think with his 11/12 children, it speaks like there's something dark about that. It isn't just the fact that he can't use contraception or he can't use condoms or he can't get the women that he's with to be on birth control. I genuinely think it's an intentional thing that he's doing, as are other like uber right-wing politicians and uber right-wing people, in that they believe that it's their mission to repopulate the world with white children. So I think it's in line with that. Outside of that, though, is another thing to note about his messy personal life is that his father himself is, how old is he? I think he's like in his 70s or 80s. But the important thing is this man had a stepdaughter. So he had a daughter who he raised with his second wife. So not Elon Musk's mother, but the woman that his father married after his mother. So he raises this little girl since she was 4 years old. But now at age 30, he has 2 children with her. So he went on to have 2 children with his stepdaughter that he raised since for like 26 years. Like we're family. And my point with that is merely that I just don't think that you can be raised by somebody who would do something like that. And on top of that, Elon has said like unequivocally that his dad was like a POS, basically, that he was no good, he was a terrible man, that he's committed every crime you can imagine, and that he just disavows him in every single way. And given that Elon is himself a villain, the fact that a villain would disavow in strong terms another villain who is his own father speaks to how bad of a character his father must be. But there's no way that you can be raised by somebody as disgraceful as Errol Musk, that's the name of his father. There's no way you can be raised by a man like that who would go on to have children with his stepdaughter he raised since 4 years old. And then on top of that, apparently he treated his mother like trash and he was generally like an abusive character growing up. There's no way you can be raised by somebody like that and that not taint you in some way. And that not taint you in a negative way in some way. Although obviously I know there's some people who are raised by just monsters and they're way of coming to terms with that is by going the complete opposite way. And that, for example, like people who are raised by deadbeat fathers, like sometimes define themselves based on not being that deadbeat father. So they go above and beyond to be present in their children's life and to be a good role model, to be a good father. I don't think that's the case with Elon Musk, especially because it's literally impossible to be attentive to 12 children or 11 children now. It's impossible to give them all the care, attention, love, presence that they require to be fully formed, emotionally balanced human beings. So as far as sort of like his career and his personal life, to me, they're the two defining things about Elon Musk, the fact that he's like a pathological liar across these different avenues. And then secondly, that he just has a very messy personal life historically and then also now. Now, the other thing I wanted to chat about was around the US elections and his role in them. The first thing is it became incredibly obvious like how powerful a tool Twitter was in the hands of Elon Musk, because he has done so many things to amplify his own voice on the platform. So for example, he has had his engineers tweak the algorithm so that whether or not you follow Elon Musk, you're always exposed to his tweets. So his tweets will get a lot more visibility than anybody else would. And that's because, you know, he wants it that way. However, though, another thing that's evident is that in his ownership of Twitter, he's basically able to like be a kingmaker, in that the way that the publicity for Trump was on the site was something that has never been seen before. Honestly, he tweaked the algorithm so that because everybody was seeing his posts, because he's tweaked the algorithm so that everybody has to see his posts, he posted like heavily for Donald Trump. Like there was one day where he posted like 154 tweets in a 24-hour cycle. And when the majority of those tweets are about Trump, it basically means that Trump is on people's minds and it drowns out effectively what the other campaign is doing. Because the reason why they say like any publicity is good publicity is because at the very least, you're drowning out the competition and you're staying at the forefront of people's minds. And that's what we saw with Twitter. It was basically a tool in which he flooded the platform in all kinds of ways with like Trump content, predominantly pro-Trump content, not just in the things that he himself was posting, but also in the nature in which like moderators have been removed that previously would prevent certain types of comments, presumably like predominantly like right-wing extremist, like racist, like ultra-nationalist comments from dominating the platform. He's removed those moderators that prevented that, and he's actually amplified those voices. And those voices were obviously exclusively pro-Trump. So through that like manipulation of the platform and his like explicit and enthusiastic endorsement of Donald Trump, Donald Trump was basically able to just get unimaginable free coverage and free press. Elon Musk also contributed $130 million to the Trump campaign over a number of months. That money was spent on advertisements. It was spent on getting like canvassers. Like he had like truckloads of people like knocking on like millions of doors, like telling them to go and register to vote, telling them who to vote for. So that money was like obviously what very well spent. On top of that, the other influence that he had over the campaign, apart from like the funding of the advertisement and the canvassing, was that he actually was the one who first suggested J.D. Vance to Donald Trump. And surprise, surprise, a few months later, Trump came out and said that J.D. Vance was his choice for a nominee as the vice president for the 2024 elections. So again, like incredible amount of influence for who is supposed to be for someone who's supposed to be an ordinary citizen like the rest of us, like, I can't imagine a scenario in which I or anybody, like any regular person, says, we would like X person to be your VP choice, and the president comes out, or the president-elect or nominee comes out a few months later and says, we've selected this person. So incredible, I would say, obstruction of democracy and of the egalitarian like values we're supposed to hold, in the sense that all citizens are supposed to have the same influence over the voting process. So, like, honestly, really disgusting forms of abuse of power. And unfortunately, it seems to be paying off. Like, immediately after Donald Trump was announced as the winner of the 2024 elections, Tesla shares surged by $26 billion. So Elon Musk is $26 billion richer since Trump came into power. And by the way, already he benefits heavily from the state. So these right-wing people, these conservatives, are always against the idea of the state giving social support or monetary support to the like people who need it, like people who don't have money, who for whatever reason need a helping hand. They're against welfare when it comes to like regular people, but when it comes to like corporate welfare, like, they are the first people out with their hands out asking for bailouts, asking for subsidies. And it's no different when it comes to Elon Musk. So most of his businesses are like beneficiaries of corporate welfare from the US state. One example is, for example, his company Tesla has received literally millions in government funding to install electric vehicle charging stations. His other company, SpaceX, has won like $1 billion government contracts for moon missions. And then also his satellite internet company called Starlink has also gotten like millions of dollars in subsidies from the federal government. So again, like, in terms of corporate welfare and corporate handouts, like, Elon Musk has already been winning. And after he has spent $130 million on Donald Trump's election, there's no way that he's not going to like continue to reap the rewards of that investment. And there's no way that he's not going to continue to be the recipient of that corporate welfare. He also, beyond like financial subsidies and financial cash injections into his businesses, he has also even asked that the Trump administration give some like official titles or roles to some of his staff. So he specifically has asked that employees from SpaceX serve as like top government officials, including in the Department of Defense. So like brazy or brazen attempts at power grabbing because he's spent $130 million on him. And I'm sure like the wins are going to keep coming once Trump officially makes it into office, because right now Musk's companies are under investigation by multiple agencies in the US government. He's being investigated by the Justice Department, by the Securities and Exchange Commission, by the National Labor Relations Board, by the Environmental Agency, by the Federal Trade Commission. Like, all these organizations or agencies have all launched investigations into him. I'm going to take a wild guess that after he has spent $130 million on Donald Trump, that all these investigations are going to go away naturally. I mean, a part of me, like the conspiracy part of me, kind of thought he bought Twitter in anticipation of the 2024 elections, because obviously he's going to make he spent $44 billion on it. I think he paid 50% of that cash. The other $22 billion was from other investors like Fidelity. But we know, like, at the time of purchase, he bought like a money losing organization. Like, historically, like, Twitter was always losing money. And even since he has bought Twitter, he has fired 80% of the employees. 80% is actually insane. 80% of the employees have been fired. And even with 80% of salaries gone, he has still managed to lose 71% of the value of Twitter. So he's paid $42 billion, but it has, or $44 billion, but has gone down in value in, by 71%. And by the way, we know that from a pretty reliable source. One of the investors, Fidelity, which is a private equity fund, basically has written off their investment in Twitter by 71%. So that's how we know. So for me, I initially thought that maybe he bought Twitter in anticipation of being able to influence the 2024 elections, because although he has spent like $22 billion of his own money, it represents like very little or a very small part of his own net worth. I think it's worth something like $290 billion. So it's not even 10% of his wealth. So it's very, it's not insignificant money to him, but it's, you know, it's just 10% of his net worth. So I thought to myself, given the fact that he is under investigation from all these agencies for all, like all these businesses of his, I'm sure if those investigations were to go forward, it would cost him more than the $44 billion. And so maybe it was just like a smart investment. I don't know. That's just a conspiracy theory. I mean, time will tell. I'm sure there'll come a time when Twitter is hauled in front of Congress and there'll be questions posed. Maybe we'll get the answers to that. But before I conclude the episode, like one of the things I came across that people talk about Elon Musk is when they look at his current support of Donald Trump and how much money he's invested in the campaign, how present he was, how active he was, they look at him and they're kind of like confused, because they thought that for the longest time he was a liberal person, that he was a liberal voter. And the reason why they say that is, first of all, even as late as 2022, Elon Musk was exchanging nasty words with Donald Trump. He was telling him to like ride off into the sunset. He was saying that he wasn't necessary. They were having like basically like Twitter wars together. And they say the reason why he shifted to the right was as a consequence of the 2020 COVID-19 vaccinations. Was it 2020? Like, time flies. I can't remember now if it's 2019 or 2020. I think it was late 2019. So they say the reason why he shifted to the right is that during COVID-19, he was forced, like many other businesses, to shut down his factories of Tesla, and that massively impacted his production timeline. And because of that, because of like the government interference, quote unquote, or the government sort of like pressure or force in shutting down his factories, he's basically like pivoted to the right. And the reason why people who are against like large governments are right wing is because they essentially don't trust the government. They think the government makes poor choices. And so the right side or conservative values are that states are incompetent. So the smaller the state is, the better it is for all kinds of things. So they basically say he's pivoted to the right because he doesn't trust the state anymore. The state has interfered in his businesses, causing him like presumably significant financial loss. And that explains part of the reason why he has pivoted to being a conservative. They also cite his daughter who transitioned, was born a boy, now identifies as a girl. And he says that because of this transition that was like shocking to him, that he felt the school misled him, and that he felt he didn't have a choice or influence over his child, he basically is like against like the woke quote-unquote left. And for me, I kind of feel like this is nonsense. Like ultimately, he's a 50-something-year-old man. And when you, I'm 32, and even at 32, I feel like I'm so set in certain values. And honestly, after the age of like 20, I would say like 28, 29, I kind of started feeling like I'm probably going to have certain views for life. There's some things you're never going to convince me of. You're never going to convince me that eating animals is not wrong, or that the way we treat animals in the meat industry is not wrong. You're not going to convince me on religion. I'm never going to be a believer again. You're not going to convince me that men, for example, aren't in a lot of cases, like, detrimental to women, that they don't hold women back. You're not going to convince me that gay men aren't misogynistic as well. There's just some things you're not going to convince me of. So that was me at like 28, 29, and that's me at like 32. I'm not saying I'm not open to certain things. There's a lot of things I'm open to, but there's some things where I've spent a great deal of time thinking about it, and I don't think it's likely to change. I'm not going to say it's definitely not going to change, but there's some things I'm just pretty entrenched in my beliefs. Now, Elon Musk is like a man in his 50s. You cannot tell me that a man who is 53 years old is going to suddenly have a change of heart at 51 years old. Like, he presumably has had like a lifetime, like half a century worth of believing certain things, of having taken in information that validates those experiences, having had experiences that validates those beliefs. So it's unlikely that at the tender age of 50, like 1-2 years ago, he would have been that he suddenly has taken such a massive change in ideology. Like, that seems very implausible to me. It's much more likely that he was always conservative with potentially like some liberal values. And another reason why you can kind of tell this is probably the case is I generally like that expression, birds of a feather flock together, because I think it's so telling of who you tolerate around you and who you hang with. It kind of speaks to your own character and to your own values, because it implies that people around you are palatable or enjoyable to you, or you enjoy their company, or you enjoy the things that they say. Otherwise, you wouldn't have them around you. And to me, it feels like he probably just adopted or performed the views that were socially required of him to be accepted into certain circles, but that he believed a different thing. And the reason why you can tell that is that he literally has supported Trump, a man who has flip-flopped on a number of issues. Like, one, there was like this meme going around showing a picture of Donald Trump where he was saying that he believed that Republicans were some of the dumbest like electorates, because you could lie to them and they would probably believe anything. And I fact checked this, and this wasn't correct. When I did my research, it turns out he's always been conservative with like some liberal quote unquote values. One of the things that I saw was that he, as far back as like 1999, had spoken about how he was very pro-choice. But like Elon Musk, he's also like a flip-flopper in that he will say whatever needs to be said in the moment, because in 1999, Trump is talking about how he's very pro-choice, but then in February 2011, he says something like, I am very pro-life. And then in 2016, he says something like, he'll defund Planned Parenthood, while he's also still praising the group. So Elon Musk hanging with other people who flip-flop on issues depending on what the political mood requires of them for them to like get ahead, to me, it speaks more to the idea that the liberal values are probably performative, because people genuinely, when they're entrenched in their views, find it very difficult to let them go. So if he had been like a lifelong like liberal, it's very unlikely that he would flip-flop in the last 2 years, and not just flip-flop and become like a conservative, because most conservatives are actually center right. They're not extremists. Like, the people we see who are like at Trump rallies or saying these crazy things on Fox News, like, I like to believe that they form like the fringe part of the conservative like side or conservative party. I like to think like most people are center left or center right. And so the fact that Elon Musk would not only like stop being liberal, but pivot to the extreme far right, to me says that he was at the very least always on the conservative side. Like, people very rarely have such extreme swings in their political views or political ideologies. To me, another like hint or clue that he was never liberal is His South African connection and the things that we can infer about like that area or that part of his life. And the first thing is, if you notice, especially in like interviews in the last 15 years, he never discusses South Africa really Like, if you go to earlier interviews when he's first, like, on the scene, he talks about how he's actually an African man, and that's, like, a novelty for him in the U.S. context, and that people don't know that there are white Africans. And so earlier in his, like, public life, he would talk about his South African connection, whereas in recent times, he rarely mentions it. And also, by the way, he doesn't have an accent, which I find very bizarre, because oftentimes if you grow up in somewhere and you live somewhere in your formative years, like, most of the time you have an accent. So they say something like, if you speak in a particular way, like, past the age of, like, either 7 or 9 or around that age, chances are you're always going to have, like, a twang of the accent that you learned that language in. So Elon Musk left South Africa when he was, I think it was, like, 17 years old. So he spent, like, the first 17 years of his life living in South Africa, speaking English in a South African way. And so the fact that he doesn't have a South African accent, to me, like, is very, very telling. It tells me that he has worked at not having that accent. He's had elocution lessons, or he's made a concerted effort to, like, wipe away that part of him. But going back to what I was talking about inferring from his South African connection that he's not liberal, is that he never discusses apartheid and what it was like growing up in such an unequal society. You would think that that would be something that would be at the forefront of his mind, or that would shape his beliefs, or that it would be something that he would talk about, because it's a very extreme society to live in. Like, we can't imagine it now in 2024, but he's somebody who grew up in a time. And I always think that as well about people who grew up before, like, the Civil Rights Bill was passed and, like, African-Americans could vote and, like, go to restaurants and eat with whoever they wanted to eat, and they could, you know, to me, people who live in that era, I'm so fascinated about how they view the world now, having experienced that. It must be so profound. It must be such a profound change and difference. So going back to Elon Musk, he grew up in the same kind of society. He lived in society that was, like, the number one feature was the fact that Black African people had no political or legal rights. Like, they didn't have rights to vote. They didn't have legal protection. They could be arrested and tortured in prison by the way, you should check out this film called Sarafina if you want to, like, watch a film that is produced by South Africans that kind of speaks a little bit about some of the experiences of people during apartheid. It's a really, really good film, and it's got great music throughout. It actually has Whoopi Goldberg in it, like, from back in the day. Great film. But anyway, it's very bizarre that Elon Musk never talks about that. Like, that is such a formative experience. It's an extreme society to live in. Presumably, it is something that taints you, that, like, affects how you see yourself, like, how you perceive your own identity as a white person, and how you view Black people, how you view Africanness, how you view African people, how you view the continent, how you view all kinds of things. And so for me, the absence of his discussion around that, like, is very, very telling. It almost tells me, like, he didn't see anything wrong with it. Because often when people are disturbed by being in a bad situation or living in a bad place where bad things happen to people, and you are tortured or tormented by the inequality that you see, it's, like, something you can't help talking about it. It, like, seeps out in your everyday conversation. It shapes, like, your values and your character and your practices, your business practices, all kinds of things. So for me, like, the canary in the mines is the fact that he doesn't talk about apartheid or South Africa in that way at all. Another thing as well is that, like, this man literally has all the money in the world. He has, like, nearly $300 billion. He's the richest man on earth right now. And with all that money, all that wealth, he has done nothing for South Africa. Like, you will never find a story where he has invested in a school, or he has invested in a power plant, or he has funded a political party, or he has helped in any way. Like, all that money, and he's never done anything for the country where he was born, his family lived, he was educated in, he doesn't do anything for that country. So again, that's another telltale sign about the fact that he likely was never liberal or never like not like a racist. And we also know that from some of the things that he has explicitly said. So not just inferring from the things he hasn't said, from the things he has explicitly said. In 2023, if you saw this, he was talking about how there was a genocide of white people in South Africa. And he was basically like trying to tap into like that like old trope that right-wing conservative racists speak about, where they basically say the white population is under attack from people of color. In this case, he was talking about South Africa, and he was basically saying that white people are in danger from the African population, from the black African population. And again, this is like classic dog whistle racism. It makes me think about Trump's own commentary around like Mexican people coming to like rape and kill like white Americans in the US, and that this is what happens when you allow illegal immigration. So again, like him making those types of comments, like again, like it smells very, very familiar. He's also had like Twitter skirmishes with South African politicians. One of those politicians was Julius Malema, who I absolutely adore. I love, he cracks me up so much. I love how outspoken he is. I love how unequivocal he is about the restoration of the money that was stolen from South Africans, and how the only route to equality is through economic reform, which I, you know, a crazy stat that I read a while back, and I'm sure it still holds, is that 90% of all resources are owned by the white population in South Africa. Like, isn't that crazy? Like, it's one of those stats where you hear and you honestly don't know what to make of it because it's so absurd. Like, 90% of all resources, all wealth is owned by the white population in a predominantly, like, over 85% black nation. That's crazy. Honestly crazy. So anyway, like, Elon Musk has had skirmishes with this guy called Julius Malema, who represents the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF party. And he has said stuff like accusing Julius Malema of trying to incite like a white genocide because he sang the song that references a song that used to be sung in during like the fight against apartheid, where people were talking about basically like dismantling or getting power over the white farmers who are actually very violent towards the African population and who represented the theft of land of black South Africans. So, you know, the only time I've seen him be engaged with South African politics is in instances like that online. And like many other like extreme right-wing people, he's like a staunch anti-immigrant person, like just like Trump or Thiel or like other super rich racists. And it's really strange, like whenever you hear like really wealthy people be against immigration, like your spidey senses should go off because it should tell you that they're racist. And the reason why is very simple. Like with working people, it's like the reason why they're afraid of immigration, or the reason why they can be whipped up into a frenzy around immigration, is that they fundamentally fear that they're going to lose their jobs to immigrants, or that domestic business owners are going to play them off against immigrants, in that because they know that immigrants are willing to accept like lower wages because they're more vulnerable and desperate for jobs, it means that the domestic population is kind of forced to compete with people who are willing to take lower wages. So they're basically afraid of incoming people who can take their jobs or who can basically like reduce the wage rate. So that's how it applies to working people, like ordinary, regular working folk. But with like the super rich, like Elon Musk, that obviously doesn't apply to them. He's not afraid that somebody's going to take his job or that his family members are going to lose jobs to people who are willing to accept poor wages and poor working conditions. Like, that's not why. In fact, presumably, business owners like Elon Musk benefit from the influx of immigration because they pay them less money. Like, presumably, even in Tesla factories, they have people who are willing to work for lower wages, people working like in assembly lines who are willing to accept lower wages than Americans, than white Americans. So the fact that he is so staunch anti-immigrant, like, doesn't make sense from like his own self-interest point of view. And to me, again, it points to the actual reason why Trump supporters like voted for Trump. And it isn't because Trump has a superior economic policy. It isn't because he's got a better foreign policy. It isn't because they believe that he's more competent. It's because he has told them in like all these explicit ways that when he comes into office, it's going to be bye-bye for immigrants. Immigrants are going to be deported. There's going to be a pause on immigration in general. And on top of that, he's promised them that he's going to ban abortions, which means that the white population is going to have a chance at growing or becoming larger. I genuinely feel like that's the only way to explain it, honestly. Because again, when you look at everything that has come out during the presidential debates, the vice president debates, the scandals that have plagued him, the criminal records, the charges, his rhetoric, the one consistent thing he has promised is racism to them. He's promised it in all these many different ways. And so for me, like, I don't care what you say, like, that's the unifying call that he has communicated to them. There are secondary calls, that the secondary calls is also that they're going to control women's bodies, but the primary call is 100% like the racial call, like the racist call, like the call that says, I'm pausing like the changing of American life or American society, and a pausing on the multiculturalism and multi-ethnicity and multi like racial groups. I'm pausing all that. And to me, like, that's where Elon Musk comes in again. Like, what does he care about immigration when he benefits from immigration because he can pay them lower wages? And even if he doesn't pay them lower wages, what does it matter to him? Because ultimately, it doesn't affect his life in any way. Like, he like, when you have that much money, you are free to live anywhere you choose and to control the, like, a great part of your life. You can choose who you see, who comes to your property, how you have to engage with the people around you. Like, you are in so much control of the environment around you at that stage. So the fact that he is so bothered about immigration to the point where he has supported Trump with $130 million, the fact that he has espoused so many conspiracy theories about the replacement theory or the population dominance of the minority groups, even though like the US still is 71% white, like, that tells you a lot about his true motivations around the support of Donald Trump. Also, in connection with what I've already said around his South Africanness and the way that he disavows it, and when he does connect with it, it's always on like the wrong side. And I really think that that's the lens through which we should see the fact that he has 12 children. Like, the fact that he has 12 children to me is so brazy. Like, and it isn't because his wife can't, or his wife and partners, like, don't have access to birth control or don't know what birth control is. I get the sense that it's part of a larger political movement from uber conservative right wing people. And there's actually a really, really good article by The New Yorker that I've linked in the section materials that you might find helpful. It's the very last one, and it is titled J.D. Vance and the Right's Call to Have More Babies. Like, it talks heavily about this. It's really insightful. So, you know, we're at the hour and a half mark. I'm going to wrap up this episode for this week. I know that I typically have a takeaway section or lessons learned or what to do going forward, but for this episode, I honestly don't have one. Like, I hate Elon Musk. I think he's trash. I think he doesn't deserve the wealth that he has. I think that billionaires' abilities to manipulate and to usurp like the Democratic vote is disgusting. And I don't even think he's going to get his. I don't think karma is coming for him. You know, he's been wealthy all his life. He's benefited from the exploitation of Africans and benefited from colonialism, then benefited from the handout from his father and his family wealth that he accumulated, and then went on to be a millionaire, and then went on to be a millionaire in the hundreds, and then went on to be a billionaire. I honestly don't think there's like a silver lining to the story. The only thing that I can hope for is that Twitter continues to lose its value to the point where he loses all the money that he invested in, and then hopefully it'll be bought by somebody else who's more ethical and it can be restored to its original glory. But again, even my hopes for that, honestly, I don't know how optimistic I am that will happen. So yeah, I'm going to leave you with that. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you liked the episode. If you did, I'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe to the podcast wherever you get it from. And then that will notify you when the next episode comes out. And I'm thinking about having episodes on Wednesday as well, but that remains to be seen, maybe in the new year. Again, thanks again for tuning in, and I'll catch you in the next one.